may proceed.
May it please the court. Before I explain why the Court of Appeals decision in this case should be overruled, I want to make it clear what the state is not arguing. The state is not arguing that defendants may be sentenced on the basis of race. The state is not arguing that the appearance of justice is unimportant. And the state is not arguing that judges may say whatever they want to defendants. What the state is arguing is that the Court of Appeals erred by creating a new, standardless basis for vacating sentences. Specifically, the state argues that the Court of Appeals erred in three important ways. First, the Court of Appeals did not follow established sentencing law. Under established sentencing law, context is critical. Each comment must be read in the context of the sentencing transcript as a whole, and each sentencing transcript must be read in the context of the record as a whole. The Court of Appeals ignored context. It cherry-picked a few comments out of a 32-page sentencing transcript. It evaluated those comments without considering what came before them or the complete record. Second, the Court of Appeals did not articulate a clear legal standard. It set forth four perspectives from which to evaluate comments and failed to provide any real guidance on what sentencing judges can and cannot say. Faced with such uncertainty, sentencing judges may shy away from considering relevant sentencing factors or from fully explaining sentencing decisions. This outcome is particularly likely given the independent review doctrine. Third, the Court of Appeals ordered a remedy that does not fit with its analysis. It remanded the case for resentencing without consideration of the defendant's race, even though it repeatedly recognized in its opinion that the sentencing judge was not racially biased and considered all appropriate and relevant factors. In light of these errors, this court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision and reinstate the defendant's sentence in accordance with established law. As the state explained in its brief, there are already mechanisms in place to both protect defendants and the appearance of justice. I'm going to begin by discussing the comments. The defendant suggested in his brief that the state was trying not to discuss the comments and sort of trying to dodge the issue. But I want to make it clear that the state does not believe that the comments, A, provide a basis for reversal under established law, or B, created the racist or sexist overtones that the Court of Appeals and found and the defendant argues. Number one, I think
just
that
so I understand, you don't think these comments were racial or sexual, gender-based in any way. Is that the state's position?
Yes, and I can go through my analysis and explain why that
Okay.
First, I think it's important to take the comments in context. I think context is really important. And by context, I think there's two important things to consider. One is the factual record, the context of the factual record, what the record shows and doesn't show in this case. Now, what the record does show is that the defendant was a drug dealer. He was found with a substantial amount of cocaine and also marijuana concealed in a secret compartment in his pants. He associates with gang members. He was a picture was shown of him at sentencing at a club with known gang members throwing gang symbols. He has no employment history. He dropped out of high school. He stopped attending a GED program. He used marijuana the day before sentencing, and he arrived at the PSI interview sullen and late. The record does not have any information about the race of the judge or the race of the daughter's mother, though those things were both assumed by the Court of Appeals in the Court of Appeals decision. And the record does not establish that the defendant is still with the daughter's mother, that he's a full-time caretaker of his daughter, or that he entered in some sort of economic decision to be a stay-at-home parent in conjunction with the daughter's mother, as is suggested in some of the briefs. The second thing in terms of context is looking at the context of the sentencing judge's remarks as a whole. This was a 32-page sentencing transcript. The sentencing judge engaged in extensive discussion with the defendant and thoroughly explained the sentence it gave. The judge did not make stereotypes about the defendant, criticize the defendant's race or marital status, and engaged in a fact-based analysis. It emphasized the defendant's failure to work or get an education and the defendant's drug use and drug dealing. It also really emphasized the consequences that the defendant's choices have on his daughter. Primarily the fact that drug dealing is dangerous, it creates a risk that he could end up in prison or killed, and the fact that his daughter really needs him to be around. The whole last page of the sentencing transcript, he was talking about being there for school activities, being there looking at pictures that the daughter brings home from school, the embarrassment that the daughter would feel if her daddy ended up in jail, and the devastation that she'd feel if he ended up in dead. I mean, this wasn't someone trying to discount the defendant's relationship with his daughter. The sentencing judge also expressed frustration at the number of people he personally saw coming into his court who were making similar choices as the defendants. Now, looking at the comments themselves, the "you guys" comment clearly referred, if you go to the next sentence, he said, "Where do you guys go to the comment?
Get these women."
The first comment that's pointed to is, "Where do you guys find these women, really, seriously? I'd say about every fourth man who comes in here unemployed, no education, is with a woman who is working full-time, going to school." Now, the Court of Appeals just cherry-picked out "you guys" and said that it's close to saying "you people," which has been used to convey racial stereotypes. But all you have to do is go to the next sentence from the "you guys" to see that what the sentencing judge was talking about was every fourth man who comes into his courtroom who he sees making similar choices as the defendant. It wasn't in any way racial. It was experiential.
You know, I read a story in the newspaper just this last week that 40% of households, the wife is the principal wage earner. He only sees 25%. Should have seen 40%. So how does that all fit together? I mean, why is it so unusual that the male is a homemaker? If the woman had been a homemaker, would that be different?
And I was going to get into that. I think you have to look at those comments about the women out working and him not. I mean, I think there's two points to consider. One is, I don't think the record necessarily supports that this is a nuclear family and they've made some kind of decision where he's going to stay home and rear the child full time while the wife or woman or significant other goes out and works. But secondly, when you look at the whole context, what the judge was really talking about was his frustration with the lack of initiative that this individual defendant has shown.
Don't you think taking care of children is important, or doesn't the judge?
I didn't get that sense. When you read the whole transcript, I think the judge takes parenting very, very seriously and is really trying to drive home to the defendant what I don't want to say good parent, because I'm not saying that this defendant is not involved with his child, but really what parenting takes and the sorts of decisions you need to make to be a good parent and how his decisions were keeping him from being the parent that he should be or could be.
Counsel, let me ask you about the term that we haven't heard about so far, the term "baby mama."
Right.
Obviously, that was considered by the majority of the Court of Appeals to be a racial comment. And the Court of Appeals, as I read the majority opinion at least, seemed to be very concerned with the appearance of bias, not with actual bias. I don't think they felt that Judge Wall had been actually biased, but very concerned with the appearance of bias. Let me ask you it this way. Is the term "baby mama" one that has meaning in the African-American community? Is it one that ties into members of the African-American community?
I think that what can be said about the term "baby mama," at least from what I just reading the documents, is that it originated in Jamaican Creole and it was popularized in hip-hop. But you can now say that it's now widely used to refer to people of all races, and even people who are married, sometimes it's used. Secondly, I think it's important to point out you need to consider how the term was used. Just because the fact is popular in a certain culture, has grammatical roots in a certain culture, if you use that term to refer to a non-racial factor, it doesn't make that factor suddenly racial. And so the court used the term "baby mama" in two ways. Both times it used it to refer to this person who was the mother of the defendant's child, which is not racial, a racial concept. The second time he used it in a sentence when he was comparing the defendant with people like the mother of his child and people like Marines and other people who were, the court deemed to be making more productive or better choices in society. So those are non-racial concepts. And the mere fact that the term "baby mama" may have African-American grammatical roots doesn't make those concepts racial just because you use that term.
Is it legitimate for the Court of Appeals and for this court to be concerned about the appearance of bias, especially racial bias?
Yeah, I think the state has a huge, prosecuting people and getting them sentenced is an awesome, awesome responsibility, and the state has no interest in having that. It's sort of status be compromised by having there be an appearance of injustice. But I have a couple of responses to about appearance of bias being a concern. One, I think that current established law has mechanisms in place to protect the appearance of justice and to avoid the appearance of bias. And I mentioned several in my brief. Two I'd like to really focus on here is one, or three I'd like to focus on here. One, when defendants are sentenced based on invalid or improper factors, such as race, they are entitled to have their sentence vacated. No state does not dispute that at all. And in a way, that seems like a different sort of claim than the one being raised here, and it definitely is. But as a practical matter, the same factors are going to be considered. Unless the court, a sentencing court, clearly says, I'm sentencing you to jail instead of prison instead of probation because you are this race or that national origin, we're always trying to get an intent. And kind of like in the jury instructions, it's always sort of circumstantial evidence, and we're always looking at comments to try to figure out why a judge sentenced a defendant like it did, he did or she did. You've got comments on a spectrum. You've got comments that are really innocuous and comments that are really insightful and inflammatory and hateful and obviously racial. So I think we need to judge those comments, but we need some standard for doing that. And established law, under current law, the standard is whether the sentence was actually based on race. You take the comment, and there could be comments that are so inflammatory and insightful that you don't need to look at much else than to know that the defendant was sentenced based on race. But in addition to looking at that comment, courts, if you look at the first case or all the cases cited in the brief, also consider the context, the sentencing comments as a whole, whether or not there's a nexus between an irrelevant and improper factor and some relevant sentencing consideration, the length of the sentence the defendant received, whether that factor was used to justify giving imprisonment rather than probation as a sentence. So one way that under established law, we avoid the appearance or protect the appearance of justice is not allowing sentences to stand when defendants are sentenced based on improper factors. Two other ones I want to discuss. Another one is that we require sentencing judges to A, consider individual defendants individually, not stereotype them or group them together or engage in mechanistic sentencing. And we also require defendants or sentencing judges to fully explain the sentences they give. In State v. McCleary, this court really talked about why that promotes the interest of justice, our appearance of justice. A, it helps defendants and the public understand why people get the sentences they do, and B, it helps appellate review of sentences. I think this court will have a much better chance keeping defendants from being sentenced based on improper factors if they encourage sentencing judges and create laws where sentencing judges fully explain their sentences to this court, and courts of appeals are able to get in and really see why defendants received the sentences they received. A third thing that's not a basis for resentencing, but is another way under established law we protect against the appearance of impropriety, is the Code of Judicial Conduct. The Code of Judicial Conduct is very, very focused on the appearance of justice. And there's something in the Code of Judicial Conduct, they differentiate between substantive claims and then ethical issues, and there's a distinction made. And it seems like in this case, for example, the focus is really on the style of what the judge said, not the substance of what the judge said. And seems to me that that kind of thing could be something in, if there's...
I'm not sure I understand the difference between style and substance here. What's the style? It's hard to tell. We don't have a audio or visual aid. All we have is a typed manuscript.
Right.
So what's the style?
I think the Court of Appeals, to me, seemed mostly concerned with how the judge communicated what it communicated. It repeatedly said that the court was not racially biased and considered all appropriate and relevant factors. What it was concerned about is how the judge said what it said would be perceived as
I think racial. There's general agreement there's no actual bias here.
Right.
There's no reason to think this judge was actually biased. This is an appearance case, right?
Right.
Okay.
There's another point, though, that you raised that I'd like to bring up, and that involves the Court of Appeals' ability even to determine how comments would be perceived. I mean, you mentioned there's no audio or visual, and really I think context really matters, and how things are said really matters, and I think the Court of Appeals has a limited ability to figure that out. So that's something else to note.
Well, if they can't figure it out, who can, or is it unreviewable in your view?
I think that's why we really need to go back to what established sentencing law has and review comments under whether or not a defendant was actually sentenced on the basis of an improper factor such as race.
How about this language? He's talking about, this is the judge talking about gangs and that the defendant is part of the gang. It's page, petition appendix 148, that's yours. I'm not sure, then he goes on to say, they all look like they're dressed to the nines as that genre would dress. Baggy clothes, chains, jewelry, looking slick, and throwing gang signs. Completely unimpressive. Does that language bother you? And then he talks to the, he asks the defendant how much his pants cost and how many pairs of pants he has.
You know, it's really hard for me, and I think this gets into the difficulty of what the reasonable observer standard would be. I mean, it's edgier than maybe I would talk in, but I just don't talk that way. I mean, but I think it's, it doesn't mean that it provides a basis for resentencing. And the fact that it would bother me, I don't think means that much or not.
He talks about how serious this is, and it is. It's crack cocaine, and he's also smoked pot since he's 16, and he thinks his mother should support the habit, right? The judge says that. All right. Then he talks about Mexican, he was reading an article about Mexican drug gang that had taken over a town and informants were decapitated, and that heroin comes from Afghanistan where our young children, I think he's talking about service people there, are being killed, right? People Mr. Harris's age are enlisting in Marines and Army and National Guard. Do you think that's all, while he sits at home getting high with his baby mama, works and goes to school, is that all appropriate in sentencing? Because we have a long sentence here. I'm trying to see whether it's all appropriate, directed.
I think what you take it into the context of what the judge was trying to convey, yes, he was talking about all appropriate factors. I mean, I don't think he sentenced. There's no question. I mean, there's no allegation that the defendant got sentenced more harshly because he had nine pairs of jeans. Or
trying to impress on the defendant the consequences of his conduct, illegal conduct.
Right. I think, you know, this court, especially here, I mean, understands the importance of justice being accessible to everybody, and there's different ways you do that. You come here. I think judges want to speak in terms that defendants understand, and there's sort of a difference opinion. Some people think judges should always sound very judicial, and some people think that they should try to talk to the people they're talking to and really engage the defendants. And I think that that's what this judge was really, really trying to do here.
Do you think the judge was being a bit sarcastic? When I read some of the comments, like, where do you find these women? Is there a club? And there were other comments about he stays home, gets high while his baby mama works and goes to school. I swear there's a club where these women get together and congregate. Was that a bit sarcastic, do you think?
It was, but fortunately, at least for the state position, there's another State v. Harris case, and sarcasm and things like that are not a basis for resentencing or vacating a sentence under established law.
So you think as long as it's not racial, it's okay to be sarcastic? Is that what you're telling me?
I think to the extent that sarcasm is a problem, the way for dealing with that would be the Code of Judicial Conduct. It would not be vacating a sentence. There's a point that you raised earlier, Justice Crooks, that I wanted to bring up again, too. You talked about the appearance of bias, and there's some cases where we discuss that. And I just want to clarify, there is a strand of due process case law where they talk about the appearance of justice being important. That kind of case law is distinct from here. What they're really talking about in those cases is the probability that a judge of bias in those cases. There's in most of the cases, there's some kind of structural thing. For example, the judge receives payment. The judge receives payment, for example, depending on a claim. The judge was heavily involved. For example, was the judge when a witness engaged in the contempt action that the judge is then sitting on? Those types of cases, and that is distinct from here.
Certainly, the cases that the Court of Appeals relied on from other jurisdictions seem to be much more extreme than what was being said here. But we do have some case law here in Wisconsin also. The case that involved the comments about religion and about how the defendant was being sentenced because he didn't go to church on a regular basis. Does that help us at all in resolving this case?
I think it does, and I think it very strongly supports the state's position. The first case, the defendant in that case was resentenced, or his sentence was vacated because the sentencing judge actually or didn't give him probation, gave him incarceration instead because of his religious beliefs or lack thereof. It said it viewed religious attendance and religious belief as a mitigating factor, and it chose not to give the defendant probation because of that. At the post-conviction hearing, it reaffirmed that it considered religious belief an appropriate sentencing consideration and a mitigating factor. And if you go through the case law, there's cases in the First Amendment context and in the Fifth Amendment context, and the courts there are looking at comments just like the sentencing judge or the Court of Appeals did here, but in those cases, they're really looking at the context. They're looking at the comment, they're looking at the context it was made, they're looking at the sentence it received, and whether there was a nexus between the consideration of an irrelevant factor or something that could be irrelevant with something that was relevant, like a nexus with the criminal activity, a nexus with a condition of probation, something like that. And I think when you look at those cases, it underscores the concerns about the chilling effect that the state talks about here. We want judges to know as much as possible about defendants, and we don't want them to be scared off about talking about things that under established law they can and should be talking about, because there's this standardless thing out there that a court of appeals could pick up one or two comments, take them out of context, and vacate a sentence because somebody, you don't quite know who, could find the comment offensive.
Counselor, if we were to conclude that these comments were offensive and improper at sentencing, would we also have to conclude that he was treated unfairly in the sentencing itself before we could remand back for a new sentencing?
This is what's so weird about this kind of perception thing and the remedy. Like, for me, the remedy doesn't fit at all with what the Court of Appeals found, and that's why the Code of Judicial Conduct seems, if it's solely just an appearance of justice and there's nothing else, that may be the best way in my mind to deal with it. In the first type of line of cases, and when there's a sentencing actually based on an improper factor, it's kind of like a structural sentencing error. There's automatic reversal. There's no question of whether there's harmless error.
What was the sentence here?
The sentence here was 2 years in, or 2 years initial confinement and 5 years extended supervision. Wait, 2 years initial confinement and 3 years extended supervision.
And what was the maximum sentence in that he could have had?
10 years initial confinement, right, and 5 years extended supervision.
So 2 years plus three. It was a three, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Does not, are you going to say that sounds reasonable in the ballpark for this kind of offense?
It's certainly not the maximum, I can say that. It doesn't seem like a particularly high sentence.
He was made eligible for the boot camp after 12 months, was he not?
Right, he was. And one thing I wanted to point out is the defendant mentions in his brief that the state did not support a drug treatment program. I would just want to note, too, that the defendant also didn't want that program. He wanted straight probation. So neither side wanted that.
This is a difficult case, I think. And earlier on in your comments, you said, of course, don't take things out of context, and there's no one here in this whole room and say, oh, yeah, we should take things out of context. You make the distinction between, this isn't racial, this is experiential. That's what you said earlier, that these comments were not racial comments, they were experiential comments. And I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what that means. I think of the case that the first case, FUEREST, that Justice Crooks referred to, where a judge based a sentence in part upon his dislike that the defendant didn't have a belief system and didn't attend church regularly. And the court there said that you can't base your sentence, that's an improper factor on that kind of a factor. And so they vacated and remanded. So isn't that not necessarily religious bigotry, but rather experiential? Perhaps my experience can be that people can be that people who attend church regularly are the type of people maybe that are concerned about issues of the community and well-being for their family and themselves. I mean, why isn't that first case just experiential? Just like you're saying, these comments aren't racist. This is experience. How can you fit that into an analysis? I'm having difficulty.
When you say experiential, you mean experiential in terms of they're talking about the individual defendant?
This might not be fair. You had earlier indicated.
Okay.
You had earlier indicated that the comments, and you were referring to, where do you get these people? The frustration the trial judge here was feeling in this case, and you said the judge's comments were not racial comments; they were experiential comments.
I think when I said experiential about the judge, I was talking about he had it was in response to the Court of Appeals interpretation of you guys as racial. My interpretation of reading it is that the sentencing judge was referring to the one out of four people in his courtroom.
That's right.
So the judge wasn't making stereotypes. He was referring to a specific group of people he had experience
with. It was where you guys find these women, really. Seriously, I'd say about every fourth man who comes in here unemployed, no education, is with a woman who's working full-time, going to school. Where do you find these women? Is there a club? That's where you made the comment that those were not racial statements. Those were rather experiential statements.
I think this gets to a good point that sort of underscores what the state's saying about established law already protecting the appearance of justice. Under established sentencing law, if you're sentenced based on an improper sentencing factor, you are entitled, we agree that the state's sentence should be vacated. The defendant's entitled to have his sentence vacated. You're always looking at comments, and you have to take them in context. And if the Court of Appeals in this case had focused on that comment and said, the judge sentenced him differently because it was sort of predisposed to treat all these people a certain way, or this was an improper factor, and applied a standard under established law, I don't know that the state would be here. It may disagree with that or find that an erroneous application of established law, but it wouldn't be here. What's the problem with what the Court of Appeals did is the Court of Appeals didn't apply any standards. It didn't consider the comment at all in context. It just cherry-picked something out, gave what I think isn't a good interpretation of it, one that doesn't even fit with the sentence that came right after it, and said that the comments had racial overtones. I think that's what the state is really concerned about, and that's why it petitioned for review in this case.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is what's presented here is a broader issue than this particular case. And the broader issue as I see it, which is what you started out with, was how does an appellate court review this? And because you agree that if there is a racial aspect to the sentencing or reason for sentencing, it should be overturned, right? Or gender or ethnic, okay. So I read your brief, and on pages 18 and 19, it seems to me you try and set a standard, and I want to try and understand them. You want the defendant to establish that any comments are such that any reasonable person who heard them would question the sentencing judge's ability to sentence the defendant without considering race. Right? That's on the top of page 19. So suppose that some reason, the whole thing about being reasonable is you got reasonable people on both sides, right? Some may say it's reasonable to think it's racial, and others may say it's reasonable not to think it's racial, right? So if that's it, if reasonable people could differ as to whether this is a racial thing, defendant loses in your mind? Is that what it is? Is busy and the defendant has to show that every reasonable person would think that this is racial? Is that what your standard is? It's like saying that no reasonable person could think on the basis of this record that, and you can fill in that the fact was there.
I think what I was trying to get at is the state's troubled by the fact that 2 out of 3 Court of Appeals judges can look on Wikipedia at a couple terms, take a couple terms out of context, and vacate a sentence based on that. So I think the threshold has to be higher than just a reasonable person could think it. This is the best language I could come up with after several permutations to try to figure it out.
I noticed there's several permutations in your Court of Appeals brief and then also in your petition to review. I think there are different ways of stating it. And it's because it's a tough standard to state.
And I'm looking at it again, I've also been looking at the judicial notice statute. There it's something
right.
That a judicially noticed fact must be one not subject to reasonable dispute and capable of accurate and ready determination.
Say that slower. I know where you're reading from. Go ahead.
A judicially noticed fact must be one not subject to reasonable dispute and capable of accurate and ready determination by resort to sources whose accuracy cannot be reasonably questioned.
But you can't use that latter part because there may or may not be sources, but you can use the first part. Not subject to reasonable dispute. Well, if two judges here think that it is and one doesn't, is this subject to reasonable dispute?
That's
the toughest part of this case for me.
What the standard should be?
What the standard should be, yeah.
I mean, my argument primarily is that there should be no standard, that we should just stick with established law. I mean, and I think when you try and you start really trying to come up with good standards, it sort of underscores the problem with what the Court of Appeals did.
Well, what you say, stick with established law, but I'm not so sure I understand what that is. You're entitled to vacate if based on improper factors. Well, the allegation here is it's an improper factor. So that was your first standard as I took it down, right?
But I think it's the million-dollar question is how do you determine whether a sentence is based on improper factor? On page 9 of this brief, Harris asserts...
On your brief, counsel?
No, on Harris's
brief. The blue
brief,
okay.
The blue brief.
This is Mr. Gould's brief.
And I think this is how difficult it gets. Under established law, factors that could be improper in some contexts are proper or can be proper if there's a sufficient nexus in all those standards that... Do you want me to finish answering this?
You may finish the sentence. Go ahead.
Okay. He says, no case directly holds that a court may not consider or allude to race and gender at sentencing. However, criminal defendants are entitled to equal protection of the law, so the point is indisputable. He's in effect saying you can never even mention race or gender because criminal defendants are entitled to equal protection of the law. Well, that's not what our established law is, and there's a lot of instances where courts can and should be talking about factors that could be invalid but are sufficiently related to relevant factors that they merit mention in individual cases.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Michael K. Gould, the State Public Defender's Office in Milwaukee, counsel for Mr. Harris. Mr. Gould?
It's not a controversial proposition that race and gender doesn't have any place, especially not as an aggravating factor at sentencing. The comments, when we consider the totality of the circumstances that were made by the trial court, would indicate to a reasonable observer that the court was viewing Mr. Harris through a lens that was tinted by racial and gender stereotypes. The racial stereotype would be that of the lazy, irresponsible black man who fathers children out of wedlock and neglects his parental responsibilities. The gender stereotype is sort of the stereotype of the traditional family structure of a working father and a stay-at-home mom, and that would be viewed as the preferable arrangement. The court you know, in its sarcastic comments about the club of women, and especially when he was pronouncing the sentence, he said he stays at home and gets high while his baby mama works and go to school. Well, that, first of all, wasn't an accurate reflection of the record. Mr. Harris had been compliant with the terms of his pretrial supervision, and in fact was discharged because he did everything he was supposed to do.
Except he was still using pot the day before, right?
He did engage in recreational drug use the night before he was sentenced, and that's certainly not a good thing. But
well,
it's a
violation of the law, whether it's, quote, recreational
absolutely.
Or not.
But the record doesn't reflect that that's what he was doing for the majority of the period while he was staying home watching his daughter. And I'm not going to, you know, posit Mr. Harris as a role model for fathers. Obviously, he was dealing drugs and he was going to go to jail, so he's not going to be able to exercise his parental responsibilities then. But that comment just suggested that he wasn't really looking at him as Mr. Harris. He was looking at him as one of every fourth guy that comes into my courtroom, you know, in Milwaukee County. The Judicial Commission report says 88% of people sentenced for drug crimes in Milwaukee are African American.
Counselor, do you think that the sentence was an improper sentence? Was he unfairly sentenced in regard to what he got for the crimes of which he was convicted?
I think this case doesn't turn on the actual sentence. The sentence is not.
I know,
not,
but I would want to ask you that question because it matters to me.
But the sentence is not. I would not say the sentence is like horrendously out of whack. I mean, it's a tough sentence. It was more than the sentence that was recommended by the prosecutor, at least in terms of the extended supervision was longer. I think it is a reasonable interpretation to think that the stereotype or those comments, which are, they're not just offhand comments, the comments he was making went directly to one of the sentencing factors, which is Mr. Harris's character. And although the record shows that he had been, during the period of, while he was on pretrial supervision, he had been doing everything he had supposed to be doing, but that was all kind of cast aside.
Counselor, I don't know how you can say he's doing everything he's supposed to do when he's dealing crack cocaine and he himself is smoking marijuana the day before he comes in. You're losing me on that one.
Well, he was dealing crack cocaine when he was arrested, but then he was placed on pretrial supervision and all his drug tests were negative. He made all of his scheduled appearances. There's no evidence other than his admitted use of marijuana the night before he's going to probably go to prison, and that's bad, and his drug dealing was bad. And those, you know, his drug dealing could justify a prison sentence. I mean, there's no dispute about that. He was in a higher, the drug category is not the lowest amount. It's a higher amount. So,
right. So your concern is with the words the court used, not with the actual sentence Mr. Harris received.
Right. I mean, I would be making this argument even if he had gotten less than what he had, the court had gone under. The thing, although maybe the client would have not wanted to proceed in that instance, but I think the comments themselves are what's problematic. It doesn't really matter overall what the sentence is, because it could have been, if it was longer or shorter, it would still, the comments would still be there and would raise a reasonable concern that race and gender played a factor in the sentence.
Counselor, if I were to buy your argument and agree that it appears that there were improper comments made in regard to race and gender, but that the sentence wasn't a sentence that itself was not appropriate for the crime committed, is that enough to order it back for resentencing, or do I have to conclude also that the sentence itself was out of line before I can send it back if I buy the first part of your argument?
I think the first argument that you made, it would be sufficient. I don't because it's really, you know, and this court has said in Galleon that like exact precision in sentencing is not required. I mean, the judge doesn't have to explain why it's 4 years and not 5 years, or so there's no way to quantify what effect, if any, that this had. And the Court of Appeals, you know, did not, they said this, they don't, we don't think the actual sentence is based on race, but there's the concern about that. I'm not so sure. I think the sentence could have been unconsciously based on some of these factors, but I mean, there's no way to distinguish between the comments and the other reasons for the sentence. The comments, like the chief quoted a bunch of some remarks about people in Afghanistan, and I mean that seemed to me kind of irrelevant. But that's not there's you'll see lots of comments like that in when a judge is making sentence. Some comments that really don't have anything to do with a particular defendant, and they're just sort of the judge thinking out loud. And I didn't challenge those. But these comments go directly to Mr. Harris's character, and I think the judge, and I don't think the judge's view of Mr. Harris was on because of them, wasn't really accurate.
I think the question really is, assuming, comments are either racist or gender stereotype or ethnic, can you have harmless error? In other words, suppose the judge here really ran off and we don't have any dispute about the nature of his comments, which is not true here, but suppose that was true, and then gave your client probation. Now, I know he might not be here, but isn't that harmless error? I mean, that's really a question that was being asked you as I hear it.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm. I still don't think so, because it still raises the question whether race in some way, there might be judges that are incredibly lenient, and even if race did play a factor in their consideration, it wouldn't matter. And you're right, as a practical matter, we wouldn't be here if he had gotten probation. But I think that it's the comments themselves are disturbing, not only we need the appearance of justice, and would the people in the courtroom perceive them as problematic? Now, I'd like to talk about the standard. I don't think there's a lot of distance between the standard used by the Court of Appeals and the standard posited by the state, but there is the concern, which was raised by the chief, that like any reasonable person could be like every reasonable person. I'd like to posit a thought experiment. What if we have an audience that's composed of half black people and half white people, any reasonable person, you could say, well, if the majority of the people, which would be white, if the audience reflected a cross section of the American public, might not think that the comments were racial, but I would say that, you know, there's a substantial likelihood that the African American portion of the audience would perceive those comments as racially tinged or biased, which is why, as with complaints made in the employment discrimination thing, you have to take the comments from the perspective of sort of a diverse audience, or the position of what would a reasonable person in the defendant's position think. And I mean, it has to be reasonable. You can't, there are some comments which might not be. That might be a little off, but wouldn't be a reasonable reading of these
Gould,
comments.
Mr. Gould, let me interrupt you for a minute and ask you this. As I understand the phrase baby mama, apparently that comes from a Creole environment, but hasn't there been some change in that over the course of time, some evolution, so that it's a much more common term and not just something that's utilized in the African-American community?
Well, it originates from there, and there's some dispute. Apparently, in the amicus brief, they say it comes from black English, and it's just the dropping of the possessive, so baby's mama becomes baby mama.
At one point, didn't the judge say baby's mama
He did say baby's mama, and then in the second comment, he was kind of it seems like he was almost adopting African American patois in making a comment, which was coupled with a very sarcastic comment about this supposed club of women. And I am not arguing that merely the use of the term baby mama is that would be enough to get a resentencing. I'm saying that in the entire context of the court's remarks, that baby mama, which as cited in by the Court of Appeals and also in the amicus brief filed by the NAACP, there's numerous instances where the term suggests it's not just the unwed mother, but an unwed mother who doesn't really have any relationship with the father other than the one that involved the conception of a child. and there's, you know, or, and it, so it does have, you know, or at least based on these pop culture references, but it's a pop culture term. How else are we going to discern the meaning of this word but by, with reference to pop culture sources? It's frequently used in a derogatory manner. Now, whether the trial court meant that or not, I mean, we can't tell. But certainly, the sarcastic comments which followed it, you know, about the Club of Women suggest that it wasn't intended in a racially or in a neutral way, or would permit a reasonable inference from that.
Counsel, can you help me out? I'm seeing in here where the assistant DA is trying to bring the court up to speed on what the investigator wants the court to know. Apparently, he has some friends or people he associates with that were convicted of delivery, each of them convicted of felony delivery of drugs. And then it talks about how apparently he has a significant, this defendant, drug issue. That's at page 6 of the transcript, that he has discriminating taste, though. He only likes middle-grade or high-grade marijuana. He acknowledges he gets angry sometimes when things don't go his way. Then it goes on, and, you know, back when we're talking about clothing, that's when the court's talking about him throwing some gang signals and wanting to be part of a gang or being part of a gang or a gang wannabe. Was that in court that he's where the court says, and he's clearly throwing gang signs with a group of individuals?
That was, he's referring to a photograph which was submitted by the state of the defendant and three other people dressed in, I guess, what you would call hip-hop clothing,
okay,
if you've seen rap videos. So that's what he's talking about, is that photograph.
That's where part of the reference to the clothing comes up.
Right, he wasn't doing that in court.
But then when he was arrested, the drugs were actually found in a part of his belt, of his
pants.
They
were in like a hidden pocket or something.
He hid,
yes,
his stash in his pants that he was wearing, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, his clothing was somewhat relevant since that's where they found
right,
the drugs.
Right, and I'm not quibbling, or I don't have any problem with the clothing references per se.
Where, if I read this transcript, where does it say what his race is?
Well, the photograph is.
But where does it say his race anywhere?
Mr. Harris's race? Well, I don't think it's specifically referred to in the transcript.
Okay.
Could the trial judge identify his race?
I don't think he would have had any problem from the photograph and. You know, I've seen my client.
Yeah, are we making assumptions?
I don't think that's in dispute.
I'm just wondering, think we're making assumptions? Because you're saying this is a race-based sentencing and a gender-based sentencing, but nowhere in the transcript, at least, and that's why I'm asking for your help. If the judge references his race,
yeah, I don't know if the photograph is made part of the record. But, I mean, it's clear from the photograph. I have seen the photograph. This is an African-American defendant. That's not.
Mr. Gould, I'm having a little difficulty trying to figure out exactly what the significance of this case is. What do you hope to accomplish for this particular defendant?
That he gets the remedy of a resentencing, which is a pretty simple remedy. It takes all of about an hour to accomplish a resentencing.
Do you think there is a realistic chance that the sentence will be different?
I think it could be because, I mean, the pre-sentence report recommended the felony drug alter to prison. He's already completed his prison sentence. He's on extended supervision because of the time lapse. But maybe his extended supervision would be shorter, or the conditions would be less onerous. I don't know at this point. I mean, it was, you know, because of the time that it's taken to go through the system, it's, you know, the actual benefit that he would accrue from getting a resentencing is diminishing.
Can the trial just give him a heavier sentence on resentencing?
Well, if there were facts, you know, that could be, there would be a presumption that that was penalizing him. But if there are facts that occurred, if he got picked up a new case, for example, while he was out, he could get a longer sentence, yes. So if there's negative information that comes to light in the interim before a resentencing, yes, he could get a longer sentence.
You say he has actually served the confinement?
Yeah, it was a two-year period of initial confinement, and it's been over 2 years since his pretrial credit.
He'd still be on extended supervision?
Correct. I mean, he's on extended supervision.
But isn't the real significance of this case, in your view, what is the real significance of this case, in your view, beyond the direct impact on the defendant?
Well, I mean, this case is a very, this set of facts is very, very unusual, because it's pretty rare that I want to go back to what the state said. I mean, sarcasm by itself is not, and there's plenty of sarcasm. I mean, frequently, the defendant's protestations of having, you know, seen the light and this is the last time you'll see me before and those kinds of things are treated with quite a great deal of sarcasm and that, you know, there's no, I don't perceive that would be a basis to challenge the sentence. The problem here is that the sarcasm is coupled with remarks that touch on areas, of race and gender, and that is something that, you know, shouldn't happen, and would be a basis for resentencing. So, I don't think that this case is going to have a substantial impact on how trial courts conduct business, because most of them wisely would refrain from making comments such as the ones that were made here.
Is there any major city in the United States where there are more non-marital children born than Milwaukee?
I have no idea. I just don't know. The problems perceived by the trial court, and I'm not saying that they're irrelevant, you know, the problem of absentee fathers and unwed mothers are, you know, endemic to many urban areas.
You were starting out when the questions changed focus as to what the standard is, and you were saying that you didn't think your standard or the Court of Appeals standard is much different than the state's, and you had a situation of a mixed race group as your standard.
Right.
I
would say a reasonable observer rather than any reasonable observer. I mean, obviously, reasonable minds can differ, but if, like, say, from a perspective of an African American or African American audience, would reasonably, that the comments would suggest to them that there were stereotypes, racial stereotypes being used, that should be sufficient. It doesn't have to be anyone, every single person or even a majority of people. It just has to be a reasonable interpretation of the comment.
So you'd put a reasonable person standard on it, which a standard well known in the law but hard to apply.
Well, we have it.
Go ahead.
We have reasonable person standards for, you know, probable cause. A reasonable police officer would, you know, have believed that there was a crime taking place. We have sort of reasonable defendant or a reasonable person in the person's position would foresee a risk of harm in a tort case. So, it's hard to apply, but I'm not sure what else you can use. You know, you have to consider the totality of the circumstances, and if you look at the totality of the circumstances and you can conclude that that's a reasonable interpretation of what the court's remarks are, then the defendant's entitled to resentencing.
I assume that you'd take the position, but maybe you wouldn't, that sentence doesn't have to be based on race, but that a race may have come into the consideration. Is that your position?
Yes, that is. It's very difficult to quantify, like, what, we can't get inside the court's head to determine whether or not it actually, had some role in determining what the length of that sentence would be. Would it have been less without it? Or if you ask the question, would he have given the same sentence to a white defendant, or would he have made the same remarks to a white defendant? From this case, it's not clear that you can give an unqualified yes to that.
One of the difficulties for me is that some of our jurisprudence dealing with what a reasonable person would think is in the area of bias. Now, this is a little bit different, but it has some of the same underpinnings. And when I think of, we've had lots of juror bias cases, and then our focus is more on whether a reasonable person in the juror's position could or could not be biased, for instance, an objective bias. But then we're looking at in one direction. And the concern I have with this standard is that it's rather a scattergun direction. Usually we talk about a reasonably objective person think that the judge is biased or that the juror is biased. But here it is, would a reasonable observer, Court of Appeals is saying, a reasonable person in the position of the defendant or a reasonable observer suggest that it was improperly considered the defendant's race in imposing sentence. And one of the problems is, where is that observer living? You know, what's that observer's life experience? I mean, I live in Wausau, and a lot of the people that I interact with socially happen to be in the ballpark of my age. Now, that's a real wide ballpark, anywhere from about 20 to 40, as I see it.
Oh, yeah, right.
But I'll tell you, not
We're
one...
We're going to take judicial notes.
Yeah, right. But not one of them have ever in my life that I have heard said, baby mama. So that's the problem when it suggests to a reasonable observer. Well, depending on where that reasonable observer lives, the life experience, a number of things, age. If I talk to my kids, they'd probably say, "Oh, Mom, I'm so embarrassed that you said that in oral arguments." Of course, a lot of our friends use that phrase, you know? And so it just gets a bit imprecise. And the imprecision bothers me, because I like standards, you know?
Right. Well,
I like to be rigid. That's right. Thanks, Chief. Yeah, I needed that.
I wish I could give you a fine rule, but that's the problem with any reasonable observer standard. And you know, as illustrated by, you know, whether it's a white person, a young person, an old person, and that's why the problem I have with the state's any reasonable observer standard, because I think there are plenty of people who would read these comments and not be have the
sure.
same reaction to them that I had when I read them. But I think that's why you need to consider sort of a totality of the circumstances. Who is the person on the receiving end of the remarks? What are the context? I mean, obviously it's a reasonable observer who knows what the term baby mama means and how it's done. But I think that, you know, that courts who are going to be applying that standard can educate themselves to the point where they, you know, have a broader view, not just the parochial view of someone, a lay person in Wausau or Dodgeville.
If I may, the test is, as the Court of Appeals indicates, that suggested to a reasonable person in the position of a defendant. Now, that's a little easier for me because it's still...
Right, and there is a scattergun approach to the Court of Appeals opinion. It's not, you know, it's not perfect, and I think that's a good place to start, and maybe the best place to rest, because it is the defendant, after all. These remarks are addressed to the defendant and explain to him why he has to go to prison for 2 years and be on extended supervision for 3 years. Although, of course, they are also addressed to the record, but. And it's the defendant a reasonable defendant would knowing what he knows and what his language is, his cultural background is, would he feel that he was sentenced that this was a fair sentence? And I think an answer in this case would be no. He wouldn't. would feel that way because of the sarcasm coupled with the unfortunate use of a term which at least originated in Black English. I can say I'm not saying every use of the term baby mama, if it was used in a more neutral way without in a different setting, I wouldn't necessarily be here. But,
how would you think we can improve the Court of Appeals decision if we held your way?
Well, I think it would be good to provide some guidance as to, I think that the hypothetical questions posited by the statements brief have answers, most of them. If some of those concerns can be addressed, I mean, it's sort of a reasonable, because really what you're talking about at the end of the day is a reasonable judge interpreting these remarks with all the research tools at their disposal.
If you had committed a very serious crime and I were the sentencing judge and you're Hispanic and I said to you, you are one bad hombre, would that convey some kind of bias against Hispanics?
It's a little problematic. If it was just that standing alone, it probably wouldn't be enough to get over the thing. I mean, there's no and sometimes vernacular terms are used to get across a message. I think we have more than that here. I don't think just the adoption of some term would be thing. Just as I have conceded that the term baby mama in another context without the expressions of disapproval of the defendant's from family arrangement, that wouldn't necessarily be a problem.
Counsel, did you try this case? I mean, were you at the sentencing lawyer?
No.
Okay. The sentencing lawyer heard all of this and never objected, never interrupted the judge, never asked to approach the bench and talk to the judge privately. There are rules that say, if you stay quiet and you don't object and give the judge an opportunity to rectify the situation, that you have forfeited your right.
Yeah,
or waived your right, whichever you prefer, whichever is forfeiture and just you didn't do it. Waive is a voluntary, intentional, and knowledgeable.
I would say that is not that certainly the case for trial court, in the course
sure.
of a trial, but for sentencing, it's not. I mean, it isn't the case that, that you make your argument, the state makes its presentation, the defense makes its presentation, the defendant allocutes, and the judge pronounces sentencing. And it's rare, very rare, for there to be objections while the court is pronouncing a sentence. Because there's already a procedure to make what is sort of the, in effect, the contemporaneous objection by when the sentence is over, you file a post-conviction motion, goes back to the trial court. The trial court has the opportunity to clarify its remarks. Unfortunately, in this case, the Judge Wall had left the bench, and so it was handled by a different judge, so
okay,
we don't
that,
know.
That raises another question. So you had a second circuit court judge review under, 97406?
Or 80939.
Okay. Review what another circuit court judge did and say whether or not there was racial bias, right? And the second judge said no.
That's right.
Counsel, can I ask, would it make any difference if the race of the judge and the defendant was the same?
For these remarks, I would say no, because it would still be stereotypical in a racial way, and it's possible. I mean, I really don't think it would make a difference. It's a good. I mean,
I don't know the answer. That's why.
Well, I would say no, because you can have stereotypes about members of your own race. You know, you consider this person like an educated, middle class African American judge might have stereotypical views of inner city African Americans. So it could still be a stereotype, which is a kind of a racial stereotype.
The ethnic background of the judge who did the motion for resentencing, do you know?
Well, I know that it's not in the record. Okay. I believe has some Hispanic background.
Counsel, the red card is up, so
thank you
for your argument. We have 5 minutes in rebuttal. St. John?
Hi. There's been a suggestion both by the defendant and then some questions raised by the
counsel,
court.
Counsel, could you speak right into that microphone?
There's been a suggestion in some of the discussion today that maybe what the Court of Appeals did was really apply established sentencing law and that really found that the sentence was based on an improper factor, based on race, and maybe even this unconscious racism. I want to clarify that that's not what the Court of Appeals did. The Court of Appeals expressly said that the sentencing judge was not racially biased. It expressly said that the sentencing judge considered all appropriate and relevant factors. It expressly said that the sentencing judge did not intend to be racially offensive or to be offensive. It emphasized in its decision the appearance of justice. It didn't reverse the defendant's sentence because it was based on race or gender. It reversed the sentence because of the perception of it, because it wanted to preserve the appearance of justice. Underscoring the extreme departure from established law, your harmless error questions, it shows how dramatic the departure is. If you take Tiepelman and the inaccurate information type of claim, if you have a sentencing judge who actually relies on inaccurate information in sentencing a defendant, you look to see whether the reliance was harmless error. But here you've got a situation where a sentencing judge says something that could be perceived a certain way, does not necessarily have any effect on the actual sentence, and you don't apply that. It's automatic structural error, automatic vacatur of the sentencing. The discussion about the thought experiment and people in Wausau versus people in Milwaukee, I think only underscores the difficulty of the Court of Appeals decision and why this court should just affirm established sentencing law. Who is the reasonable observer? How do you figure it out? Do sentencing judges in Wausau get to say different things than sentencing judges in Milwaukee?
Well, wasn't your opposing counsel correct when he concluded that ultimately the question at the end of the day is what we're looking to, what does a reasonable Supreme Court justice think on this?
Right.
That's a hard standard to apply.
Right. If you're going to look at what a reasonable defendant said, Justice Ziegler, you asked some questions about assumptions that are being made. Though the defendant's race is in the record, it's on the criminal complaint, I believe. It said what his race is. The race of the sentencing judge is not in the record. The race of the mother of the defendant's child is not in the record. So we are ending up making some assumptions. Also, there's nothing in the record with a normal reasonable person standard in the probable cause or arrest context, for example. You actually have a fact-finding hearing of some sort. Are we actually going to have a fact-finding hearing to determine what the mannerisms of the judge were, what the defendant thought, those kinds of things. And lastly, the defendant says that he's really looking at context and he's taking these comments together. But context should not be like whether the defendant, whether the race of the defendant or the race of the sentencing judge or what a term means on Wikipedia. It should really be looking at the sentencing transcript as a whole, looking at the record as a whole, and really getting in and considering how what judges were trying to say. I think if you do that here and really look at the context of the comments, it's clear that the sentencing judge was not sentencing the defendant based on racial stereotypes or gender stereotypes.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Ms. St. John and Mr. Gould for their excellent arguments and briefs on a very difficult issue in which the Court of Appeals of three judges split three ways. That ends our hearing on 08-AP-810-CR, State versus Harris. And again, on behalf of the court, I want to thank you.